go ahead and leave the door open back there. My name is Roger Caille. I'm the director of the City Institute. And it's my distinct pleasure to welcome you to the first installment of this year's seminar series, which I can promise you is going to be very, very interesting. We're soon going to publish the entire list. We have completed it as of today. We now know who the speakers are, and you're in for some interesting conversations and presentations. Today, our first speaker is doing a lot of things at once. He is giving the first seminar series of the year. It's like the first seminar in the series of the year, but he also will do something which I'll explain in a second, which is to give sort of the inaugural talk in a new series that we're going to run side by side with the City Seminar Series, which is going to be tied to our major collaborative research initiative on global suburbanism, of which Richard Harris from McMaster University is a co-applicant, a co-investigator, one of the major brains behind the application. So we're very happy to have him here today to speak to us about meaningful types in a world of suburbs. Richard is, and that I don't say often, but I say it here, is of course somebody who would not have to be introduced to this crowd. And I'm saying that for two reasons. Number one, because of who Richard is, because he is, of course, Canada's most well-known and most distinguished scholar on the geography and the history of suburbanization. And he is, as I said, a professor in the geography department at McMaster. And he's written about segregation housing, housing policy, planning, suburban development in North America and in the British colonies. His most recently published book is Creeping Conformity, How Canada Became Suburban, 1900 to 1960, and he has recently completed the book manuscript, The Rise of Home Improvement, 1914-1960. That's out to when? Not clear yet.
A year or so.
And he's currently working on the social geography of Bombay and Calcutta, also in an historical perspective, and is, as I said, part of our project. I said that he didn't need to be introduced because of who he is, but I can also, looking around the room, say that he doesn't need to get to be introduced to this particular crowd, because when I look around the room, I can see that a lot of people that are in this room who I know about are actually working on suburban issues of one way or another, so they should be familiar with who Richard is, so I assume that is, that's the case. One of the things that I believe is true for Richard, you know, as much as for a lot of people who working on particular topics, is that sometimes a topic needs to be discovered, or sometimes a topic, a theme, needs to be put into the public discourse. And I would venture to say that to some degree one could argue that without Richard writing about suburbs the way he has written about suburbs, we wouldn't know that there are suburbs in Canada. When I came to Toronto in the early 90s, I was presented with a view of Canadian cities which was utterly false, which was written by people who thought that we were dramatically different from the United States, and we all lived in dense, walkable, and extremely urban inner cities, and we were so different. And particularly people in Montreal and Toronto believe that to this day, and you can see, and of course, that's going to be my only political comment, in the current mayoral election, that contradiction between our perception, particularly the political class and the chattering classes of Toronto, of believing that we live in a city which is dense and lined by streetcar lines, and you know, where people can walk everywhere, and where you have a specialty restaurant at every corner, that this idea of where we live has of course been tested by the right-wing populist assault that's being waged on City Hall. And I said this is going to be my only political comment. So there are still a few seats back here. There are two back behind these. There are two seats back here, one I'll take, but there are two chairs here, and it's so much more comfy if you come over here. It makes it less awkward for the speaker to look at you standing in the back. There may also be more chairs back there. So without further ado, I'm going to ask Richard to lead us through this talk on meaningful types in the world of suburbs, and I know you're in for a treat because I have read the paper. Richard.
Well, thank you, Roger, for an unreasonably generous introduction, but anyway, I'll let that pass on this one occasion. It was several weeks ago that Roger asked me to give this lunchtime talk on the subject of suburbs around the world, and my first thought was, gosh, that's rather a lot to cover in a lunchtime talk of 50 minutes or so, which is about what I'm going to subject you to. But then almost immediately I thought, that shouldn't be a problem. I mean, we do this all the time as academics. We make big generalizations, usually to undergraduate students, so really all I'm doing is making big generalizations to graduate students or faculty. But I'm assuming that's mostly not the audience today. So I think it's perfectly reasonable and possible and doable to say something meaningful about a large and important topic within the space of 50 minutes. And in fact, if I needed confirmation of that, and this is a book that is of very direct relevance to what I'm talking about today, just published within the last week, and there's been this Doug Saunders, who's the, some of you will know, the European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail, has just published this book, which certainly intersects in an important way with what I'm talking about. He was on the radio. I heard a couple of interviews this week. And in the course of 10 minutes, he managed to communicate some of the basic points of what is a very large, the scope of his book is very large. So I figured I should be able to do that too. Of course, it's possible to be superficial in 50 minutes. It's also possible to say something more meaningful. I hope that that I don't miss some of the more important things. There's a lot to be said, and I'm sure there's issues that I don't speak about today, some including some which I probably haven't thought of. So there certainly will be time for discussion and questions and comments. I very much welcome. What you're getting is sort of an abstract or a trailer for a book that I do intend to write at some point in time, not in the near future, but certainly at this point in time there's lots of opportunity for me getting feedback and thoughts about what I have to say. One of the themes, in fact one of the main themes of what I want to talk about today is the issue of segregation. And I mean, I teach my urban residential urban social geography course this term. I talk about segregation primarily as a fact out there in the real world, and of course that's part of what I am talking about today. Segregation among suburbs, segregation between cities and suburbs, and that's obviously a theme and an issue that's involved. But even more, in what I have to say today, there's a segregation in the literature, a segregation between the literature on cities in the, let's call it the developing world, as opposed to the developed world, the global north and the global south, which is the binary that I used in the actual written paper, which I wrote this summer. Or between the West and the rest, which is a phrase that I'm going to use from time to time today. All these binaries are inadequate, but there is clearly a segregation in the literature, and that's a very important theme of what I have to say. There's also a segregation between the historical literature and the contemporary literature, which is something that I've wrestled with for many, many years now. Most of my own research has been historical, but I do contemporary stuff too, and I'm always struck by how little the one group listens to the other group, and that goes completely. So segregation then in the literature, but also segregation between the literature on cities as opposed to suburbs, and that's what I'm speaking to. There has of course been an enormous amount written in recent years about globalization, global cities, and as Roger among others has been very effective in saying very recently, well, yes, and that literature, you know, thinks about, even if it isn't explicit, its mental image of urban areas is the downtown. It's Manhattan. It's, I mean, that was even, Roger was referring to that, I think, in his introduction. And, you know, I'm not going to say that that instead of an urban world, we should be thinking about a suburban world. But it is clearly true that most people in urban areas now live in, depending on on how you want to define them, suburbs. So, you know, this statistic, which has been bandied around a lot in the last couple of years, and which Doug Saunders makes something of in his book and also in the interviews, you know, 2 years ago, the world became urban, you know, with roughly now 50% of the world's population living in urban areas. Well, a disproportionate number of that percentage lives in suburbs. Well, I'm not going to go and say to the other extreme and say that we do live yet, anyway, in the suburban world, but what I do want to talk about is a world of suburbs. And that means that, I guess, in my mind, has two aspects. Firstly, I am, or I do want to speak about, suburbs around the world, north, south, east, and west. But also implied, I think, in that is the notion that there's a lot of diversity out there. And one of the questions that I'll come back to towards the end of my presentation is, you know, given this enormous diversity, and there is, what kind of commonalities, is it possible to find commonalities? And I think in the written version of my paper, I was more assertive than I now want to be about that. I'll put a question mark beside that. So this is the structure, basically, of what I want to say today. I want to say something first about, if you like, the literature. And this is the segregated stereotypes, and they are stereotypes that still exist, of suburbs in the West versus urban fringe areas, they're not always suburbs, in the rest of the world. And a lot of this has to do with the still pervasive influence of what Jennifer Robinson has called this developmentalist paradigms. You know, I mean, the cities in the developing world are framed by a developmentalist paradigm, which is one of the reasons why that literature is segregated, why it hasn't been connected and related as much as it should have been, and in some cases hardly at all, to urban theory, which is so much and to such an extent a Western sort of phenomenon. So I want to say something about those segregated stereotypes. Secondly, I want to say something about the problems, the inaccuracies, if you like, of those stereotypes, both historically, at least in the fairly recent past, going back to, let's say, the Second World War, the extent to which the reality didn't conform to the stereotype. And then I also want to say something coming down to the present, in terms of what's happening right now, or at least allude to it, because if the stereotypes were never accurate, they're increasingly inaccurate, to the point where I think absolutely we have to bridge this gap between segregation. And then thirdly, I guess this is my pitch, the ultimate kind of bottom line, is I think we really do need to think of suburbs as a global phenomenon, as a whole, the forces what they are, and the forces that shape them, and at the very end I'm going to suggest a typology which tries to encompass the diversity. With that question, okay, given all this diversity, is there really, what do they have in common? I said the literature is segregated. Here's a couple of numbers for those of you that like numbers, and I do, actually, where possible. The Web of Science database, which most of you, or perhaps all of you, will be familiar with, you know, it's a pretty extensive database. If you do a keyword search on suburb, how many articles with suburb have appeared with suburb in the title or in the abstract? Since 1975, at least through 2009, there were 7,363. There's almost, well, not as many, but there's a very large number also with squatter settlement in the title. But the number with both suburb and squatter together, just 13 in all that time. Now, there was a number of studies, at least journal article type studies, that have considered what they think of as suburbs, and of course that's the issue, what people think of as suburbs on the one hand, and squatter settlement, which everyone knows are pervasive in the developing world. The number that have considered both of those things simultaneously or within the scope of a single article is really tiny. Another indicator making the same point. What I think in many ways is actually a rather good textbook, a rather nice textbook. I like it. I like it in a lot of ways. Cities of the World, so it is global, thoroughly global in scope. If you look in the index, there's 22 entries under squatters or squatter settlements, and there's 20 entries under suburbs, and there's no commonality between those. They talk about suburbs in one place or in one region, because it's organized regionally, they talk about suburbs in one place or region and squatter settlements in another, but the two don't intersect. I mean, these are just small examples of what I'm talking about. So, as I say, let me speak in this first section of the presentation about this segregated literature. And initially, let's look at the western suburbs, and for most of you, the suburbs in the west. And for most of you, a lot of what I have to say, I'm sure, will be quite familiar. So I don't think I probably need to go on about it too much, although maybe I will, I don't know. In terms of the characteristics of suburbs in the West, the stereotype is that they're going to be residential. Workplaces are excluded by zoning or other types of regulations. The stereotype is that they're affluent or middle class, of course, more of middle class than truly affluent. And that this is promoted through the actions of real estate developers, builders, through the market. Deed restrictions or things of that kind, or just the creation of large-scale lots. Enforced, yes, by deed restrictions, also sometimes, particularly in the United States, by municipal boundaries. There's a huge literature on this. And the explanations tend to emphasize personal choice. People are choosing to move to the suburbs. Sometimes they're constrained as to which suburb they can move into, obviously by finances, but it's a constrained choice. And they are, in the process, rejecting the city. They're moving out of the city. And maybe they're fleeing the city, and the notion of white flight has had a lot of press in recent decades, particularly in the United States. But more positively, the notion is that people are moving to the suburbs because the suburbs embody this, it's an old phrase, it's an ideal marriage of city and country. It's kind of urban, but it's also somewhat rural. So these are stereotypes. I'm going to show you some images which will feel familiar, even if you don't know the specific places. This specific place you may know, even if you don't live there. Rosedale, late 19th century, obviously a suburb that this character. Lawrence Park, early 20th century, around Young and Lawrence. Also very much fitting this kind of image, as does, and these are iconic images, Riverside, late 19th century suburb of Chicago. Unusual for the curvilinear patterns that early, but certainly another place, another suburb that fits these images. This is clearly affluent, not middle class, that we're looking at here. Lots of architecturally designed, architect-designed homes, says Frank Lloyd Wright. Outside and in, and there it is today. And then, of course, bringing the story forward from the late 19th and early 20th centuries into the post-war period, of course, we have the mass suburbs, middle class, even lower middle class suburbs of the post-war era. This is Harper's Magazine, 1953, the mass-produced suburb, that kind of image, of course, the scale, and also reaching lower than this type of suburb had reached before. Again, iconic images, Levittown, I'm sure all of you will probably have seen one or both of those in textbooks or places of that kind. I couldn't resist including this. He was shilling for General Electric in 1954. So of course, and there's lots of literature on, you know, production, not just the production of the houses, but the whole political economy of this, how important suburbs were to the larger political economy, patterns of consumption, etc. Bringing it a little bit closer to home, often it is said, often not entirely accurately, but nonetheless, Don Beale's Canada's first planned community, same era, I think familiar in many ways. And this to me is, again, a very representative kind of quote from someone who really knows what he's talking about. At least he really knows what he's talking about with respect to this type of suburb. And suburbia, he says, Robert Fishman, who's written, as many of you all know, extensively about American suburbs in particular, suburbia must always be defined in relation to its rejected opposite, metropolis. Again, this is the theme of, a rejection of the city. That's what's involved in suburbanization, the notion of white flight that I alluded to before. Obviously, we've heard mostly about that in the American context, and that's been written about, as you see, Kevin Cruz's book there on the left, for example. But also, I think, interestingly, in a British and other contexts as well, with a map there, which suggests that there may be some substance to that. So there's that kind of notion of fleeing the city, and that certainly has been part of the story, but there's also a more positive movement to the city as a suburb because of its more positive attraction. It isn't just rejecting one, it's being drawn to another. And that's probably the dominant, certainly part of the stereotype. Bedford Park, London, developed 1875 onwards, often referred to, or sometimes referred to, as the first garden suburb. First suburb that kind of tries to incorporate rurality and space and parks and so forth into it. Pizarro painted this area at about the time that it was just starting to be developed. You can see some of the early development there. These are other images of its early years in the West End of London. I can say I spent a year close to, but not in this area now, and it's in the flight path to Heathrow, so it's gone a little bit down market. But it is still a nice place to be. It was the first suburb which was to be, or first area, to be designated as a conservation area in Britain in the 1960s, and you can see the lobbying demonstrations for that. Some prominent people lived there, and so on and so forth. This is part of that kind of that image, that kind of a suburb. And of course, as we move forward in time, and again, if not these particular images, this type of image will be very familiar to you. The auto-dependent suburb, Bedford Park, was very much dependent on the local nearby railway station, which then became a tube station, metro. Post-war, of course, auto-dependence. This type of image is common. We know the story. Well, that's one type, or one set of stereotypes. That's a stereotypical history, and an account of Western suburbs. What about suburbs in the rest of the world? In terms of the characteristics of those fringe areas, as I've already alluded to or suggested, at a kind of global scale, but it's also very true within the literature on the developing world, those who write about suburbs, and there aren't very many of them, distinguish them clearly from squatter settlements. And the squatter settlements, whatever the particular label is given to them, and different terms are obviously used in different places, this is overwhelmingly the dominant story of urban fringe, the urban fringe in the development. And if these places are residential, it's not because because industry's been excluded through zoning. It's because there isn't any industry. So jobs, or poor city jobs. So it's a different story there. I'm just going to show you some images of different types of owner-built, squatter-type. I mean, they do take different forms in different places. I'm very good on the pronunciation. Gage Condu. In Istanbul, and here's some more. Very unique because of very particular tenurial traditions in Turkey, sort of a hangover from the Ottoman period, but not looking enormously different from many other places. Spontaneous settlements was the term that was often used in Peru, Latin America, for example, in the 1950s and the 1960s. This photograph wasn't taken in that period, but this is kind of the mature form, or a more mature form of those types of squatter settlements, Brazilian favelas. most, but not all, suburban townships in South Africa, some of which are developed by the state and have a degree of uniformity to them, parts, and that's part of Soweto, or other parts of Soweto as the best known of the townships, developed much more informally, more like a squatter settlement. Suburban Jakarta, although the term suburban wouldn't be used, it would be informal settlement, something of that sort. these are, I would say, have been and still are overwhelmingly the dominant image, the stereotype of urban fringe areas in the developing world. And these two fairly recent books by Robert Neuwirth, Mike Davis, the covers alone, I think, really meant that. So what are the problems with these stereotypes? I mean, stereotypes can serve a purpose. Stereotypes have a bad name. They are simplified representations of the world, and sometimes they can be accurate, and sometimes they can be useful, but sometimes they're not accurate, and they're not useful. Well, let me say some things both about the recent historical past and then about what's happening right now in terms of how accurate I think those, or inaccurate I think those stereotypes are. And let's look first, I'm going to say something first about suburbs of the West and emphasize the extent to which low-income, immigrant, industrial suburbs have always been a factor, sometimes a very major factor, and Toronto's a very good example. And then looking at the rest of the world, fringe areas have always, I will argue, always included better suburbs. And some people who know particular regions know this, but this isn't part of, as I say, it isn't part of the usual kind of perception. So let's look at some western suburbs, and in particular Toronto suburbs, and flesh. And this is a suburb that I have a particular feel for, a particular interest in. I've written about it and found it most intriguing. Spent a lot of time trying to collect images of it. Here it is, Earl's Court, around Dufferin and St. Clair in 1916. And as you can see, it was pretty modest. The people settling in this area had pretty low incomes. They were also, in many cases, immigrants, British immigrants in this particular. And they were building, they weren't squatters, they owned title to the land. But they were starting out with, or starting out by building, as you can see, extremely modest shacks, which they then subsequently improved. So that process of improvement, of owner building and improvement, which is very, very characteristic, and supposedly in many people's minds, I think, still primarily characteristic of suburbs in the developing world, has been very common. In Western, certainly historically, in Western suburbs as well. If you look at a map here, this is Toronto in 1921, so about the time that photograph was taken, and the photograph was just done here. That's the built up area with the grey, the light grey shading. The open circles here indicate the main areas of blue collar settlement, and as you can see, of course, there was lots downtown. There was also lots, plenty out in fringe areas, New Toronto, up around the junction, what was then called the township, East York, out into the East End, and so forth. And there was also lots of industry out in these suburban areas as well. In New Toronto, the Goodyear factory, Ford had a plant out here, and out in the junction, of course, that was really the main centre, but also up in Leaside. So, industrial suburbs, working class suburbs, immigrant suburbs. Certainly historically an important story. And there again you see a representation, this is a watercolour, a representation of the way that people improve their housing over time, starting with a shack, then either extending it or simply replacing it with something a little bit more substantial. And this continued, this is suburban Peoria from Peoria, Illinois, the quintessential Midwestern city. Which I've also done quite a lot of research on. There was an enormous amount of owner building, industrial suburbanization, and so forth in the 1930s and the 40s and the 50s. And this was one owner built house in the late 40s. That's slightly earlier, I think it's a late 30s suburb of Peoria. Lots and lots of this sort of thing, which people are now, well, historians, urban historians, have been writing about. Sorry for the quality of these images, I just took them off the web and I couldn't get good ones. But Andy Weiss, I don't know whether you know this particular book, it's a study of African American suburbanization in the 20th century. His point being that although our images of African American settlement in US cities is very much of the inner city ghetto, that in fact that there has always been variable but often non-trivial amounts of settlement. African American settlement. Suburb matters. Becky Nicolaides, another student of Ken Jackson's, they're both students of Ken Jackson's at Columbia, did a study of Southgate, which is sort of south central, or just adjacent to south central Los Angeles, and how it developed in the first, the early decades of the 20th century, making the point that it developed very much as a blue-collar migrant and also immigrant suburb, in much the same sort of way that I talked about in relation to World School, people building their own homes, improving it, and so on. So, again, not squatters, literally not squatters, they overspend. If you look beyond North America, again, historically, or moving forward in time, it's still historically, lots and lots of examples in Europe of working class and or migrant and or immigrant suburbs. Suburbs of Paris in the 1920s were dominantly working class, and also you can see in this photograph, not surprisingly, of course, there was industry out there too. That's very much the pattern in Paris, as it was in many European, including southern European cities, working class settlement, low income settlement, fringe. Of course, this was, you might almost say, enforced or mandated or reinforced by the state in France after the Second World War, the construction of the Cour d'Ensemble, the housing projects intended originally for French, white French workers, and of course now, as we know, in the last 10, 20, 30 years, settled in many cases by North African immigrants. But these are again, as I say, working class immigrant sorts of places. So what I tried to do then in that few slides was to challenge our stereotype, or the stereotype, that Western suburbs are being middle class and residential. Well, let's look at some, again, historically, at some suburbs in the developing world. And I've done some work on the West Indies and East Africa, as, of course, have other urban historians. And if you look at Port of Spain, Trinidad, in the late 1940s, yes, there were places like this which looked like and were squatter settlements. That's what they were, and people didn't have a title. And then there were, in the context of the time, very respectable middle-class suburbs, which were also well-recognized and well-understood to be an option, obviously, for those who could afford it. But same in Barbados. The housing may be modest, and some of this, some of these are chapel houses, in fact, but it didn't necessarily have a title. But some of them were very respectable, solid, suburban settlements. A map. I have to have some maps as a geographer. Kisumu, Kenya, around 1960. I wasn't able to check the exact date, so that's why I'm circa. Somewhere I have the image. The cartographer that drew this tried to represent squatter settlements with this. Yeah. I don't know what they are. Huts, I suppose, is perhaps what they're trying to, symbolically, trying to indicate. And that's what they were. These were squatter settlements. But there were also, as you can see down here, or as you can certainly infer down here, very nice suburbs. Now, of course, this was mostly colonial, British colonial. And for the use of British colonial administrators, there's the school and the hospital and the club. And not to mention the yacht club down there. So this is a very particular, this is a small, really small city, not to all that town. But you could pick, I would argue, just about any East African city from that period and find similar kinds of diversity. I'm not saying there's equal numbers of one versus the other, but certainly diversity. So historically, then, places haven't conformed to the stereotype, and that is increasingly true. But if we come down to the present in the last 10 or 20 years, suburbs in North America, Western Europe, are, I think, very obviously diverse. I think that message is coming, is getting through. There's a few of you who are prepared. in now to stand up and simply reproduce those stereotypes that I gave you earlier, I mentioned earlier. We're familiar with problems of declining inner ring suburbs. We're aware that there are immigrants and working class suburbs. There are in-between suburbs, which don't really fit neat categories where there's redevelopment happening. They don't look like cities, they don't really look like suburbs, they simply don't look like suburbs of stereotypes. So there's that. In the rest of the world, too, also, perhaps even more dramatically, suburbs are becoming incredibly diverse. We have, and there's different labels for them, ex-urban, peri-urban villages that are being incorporated into rapidly growing urban areas, and that's part of what Saunders is talking about. He calls this a rival city because he's talking about all these people being brought into the city. And part of that story, only part of it, is peri-urban villages. There's industrial suburbs. There are affluent and gated communities now. And the existence of suburbs as opposed to squatter settlements is increasingly being acknowledged in the developing world. And again, let me show you just a few images to reinforce those points. I said in the West that it's increasingly recognized that many suburbs, immigrant suburbs, this is a study of Los Angeles, again, this isn't a very good reproduction, but speaking about some of the problems, including the decline of inner ring suburbs, older suburbs that were once thought of as suburban that are now in turn ringed by outer ring suburbs, facing economic problems, social problems, and so forth. One indication of this growing recognition that suburbs are in fact more diverse than the stereotype. If you look at that Web of Science database again and just enter working class and suburb, right? Back in the 1980s, 12.2 million in that database in that decade. In the 2000s, which of course is only 9 years in fact, 219. So, I mean, there's clearly a growth, a recognition of a new type of suburb. Images such as this. This is new suburban Paris. We're becoming aware of this. This certainly doesn't fit many of the stereotypes. Close to the home, especially your home, anyway. And speaking to the question of these in-between suburbs, which Roger and Doug Young and others, perhaps in this room, have been thinking about. Places which don't look like cities, don't look like suburbs. Another way of breaking down the stereotypes. What's happening again now, but in the developing world. Back in 1992, Brown, one observer, fairly sensitive to what was going on in Latin America, said, we can't talk about one, we need to talk about two outskirts of the cities, fringe areas. It's not just these sorts of favelas, but also, and where are we looking from here? We're looking from a much more prosperous, a more middle class kind of suburb. Perhaps that was a fair comment at that point in time to emphasize that there's two types of suburbs. Now there's many types of suburbs. And increasingly the literature is acknowledging that. There are what Terry McGee has called the desiccata landscapes, which combine rural and urban landscapes. The term that's often used, particularly in an African context, is peri-urban, not only in Africa. It's a term that's often used there. So the places which might once have been rural, predominantly rural villages, as cities expand, and some cities have been expanding very rapidly, get drawn into the city commuters, who are tied into a very different lifestyle. Industrial suburbs. No prizes for guessing where this is. All the stereotypes. Now, new suburban development, of course, has to be China. And the gated communities, which, of course, initially people thought of them primarily in relation to the United States, and now there's a whole literature on gated communities. just about everywhere. In Russia, in South Africa, in China, Latin America. And there's a debate as to whether this represents the simple diffusion of an American model, or whether it in fact involves the sort of the reinvention of, in some cases, of local traditions as well. I think it's a bit of both. So, and that moved before I wanted it to, but never mind. So if you look at the literature, and this again, this is from the Web of Science database, if you look, as you can, in that database, at the regional origins of the literature on the suburbs, of course, it's always been dominated by... Actually, that shouldn't read United States, that should read North America, because Canada's in there too. But it's always been, it still is, dominated by a literature, a predominantly North American literature, true. But things have been changing, as you can see. And particularly, that has been, just very recently, a rapid growth in the literature on, interestingly, Chinese, even more interestingly, not Indian suburbs. And I've had some conversations with Indian urbanists who say, yeah, it's kind of weird. But there's an enormous and a rapidly growing literature on Chinese suburbs, but not Indian. So it's very much East and not South Asia that's been growing, but other regions up here too. Obviously, Europe is in here, Latin America. So the term suburb, and this is the point I'm trying to say, the term suburb now is being used in relation to urban fringe areas all over the place. It's not just squatter settlements that exist in Latin America. It's gated suburbs, for example, as well. Okay, so... Is that okay? Finally, in conclusion, or concluding section. How should we think about suburbs globally? I mean, I've suggested that, you know, these segregated stereotypes were not accurate. I've suggested that there's a convergence in types, that gated communities, for example, exist almost everywhere. How should we think about that? Now, in the paper on which this talk is based, I made a pitch and said, well, we should be using the term suburb. We should be using the term suburb everywhere to designate any of these places that happen to be located at or near the urban fringe. But clearly, there are lots of people who continue to use more regional descriptors that have local meaning, local connotations, and that terminology has its use. I mean, you know, Geisha Kondo does have a very particular meaning, which suburb doesn't have in Turkey. So there's a case, you could say, for keeping these regional usages. One or two people have said we should just abandon city and suburb and just talk about settlements. But settlements that have various types of qualities, characteristics. And Herbert Gans, for example, has argued to that effect just a couple of years ago. I think the problem with the notion of these regional usages is that I think that tends to obscure the fact that there's commonalities if you only use the regional terminology. And going back to using some very broad generic term like settlement, well, it kind of evades the question. You then have to specify what those qualities are and if you want to group different types of places together, then, which I think is hugely necessary at some point, well, then you need to group them and to label them, and so you get back to city and suburb anyway. So, if we stick with the term suburb, or if we do try to use the term suburb for all these other sorts of places, we need to think about what one author, three of them, co-authored these, mentioned recently. You know, what's the type of generic problem that the suburbs bring? What is the generic characteristic of suburbs? Well, I don't have any brilliant new thoughts about that. It seems to me that the most basic notions behind the concept of a suburb is location at or near the suburban fringe, density, lower density than the city, and their novelty, their newness. And let me say just a little bit about each of those and also problem types, at least one or two of those as well. So location is Nairobi, Kenya. Location, You might say, well, that's a fairly simple, straightforward issue, somewhere that is not close to the center, that's at or near. We don't know exactly where the urban fringe is at this point. Density, well, as opposed to, and I'm thinking real extremes perhaps here, labels in 1900, a representation of downtown or inner city Toronto as a very dense kind of place. Suburban Delhi, I believe, an Indian city, I think it's Delhi. You may say, well, it looks pretty dense too. And there's a lot of suburban development now happening in many places around the world. Most recently in Istanbul, I saw a lot of them. Not exactly like that, but pretty similar to that in terms of high rises and densities and so forth. But I would argue that this, and I think this is captured very nicely by a phrase that I can't remember who first said it. But anyway, they made a distinction. They said that in cities there are streetscapes, in suburbs there are landscapes. And I would say that even in a setting such as the one I've just shown you, or this here, this is suburban Paris, what you're looking at are not primarily streetscapes, you're looking at the landscape. So people within those landscapes may be living at very high densities, and their experience, their daily experience, is very much shaped by the fact that they're living in these high rises, yes. But nonetheless, the general environment is still different. It's not suburban in the normal, traditional, stereotypical way of thinking about it, but it is still different from the city, that of the city. That said, you know, I mean, you look at this, and you think, well, you know, what is this? How do we come to terms with that? And I don't know. It's not. It's not. It's in between. So I don't know. You tell me. Newness. I guess one of the things that the third criteria that I suggested characterizes suburbs, the novelty of them. Physical novelty is the most obvious visible thing. Lots of images of new planned suburbs that don't necessarily look just like that, but they do look like that in the sense that there's a uniformity, there's an ambiguity. They're so obviously new. There's a really interesting book which I would really recommend to you by Stuart Brand. It's called How Buildings Learn. Of course, what he's talking about is what happens to them after they're built. And he's talking about buildings, but we can just about easily extend that and think about neighborhoods. Basically, what happens to them after they are occupied, lived in, and changed. And I would say that there is something not just physical, but also subjective. In terms of the meaning of a place, once it's been lived in for a period of time. Not always a straightforward or easy thing to get at that. Back in the 1960s, S.D. Clark, who was a sociologist at U of T, wrote a book called The Suburban Society, in which he argued that, and he wasn't primarily interested in the physical characteristics of suburbs, he was much more interested in the social, sociological experience of people who had just moved into the suburbs. And he said there's this period of adjustment. No one knows each other. Everyone's busy making friends, as they were on Upper Sherman, Hamilton, Ontario in the 1950s. This is a block party from some personal records, actually. This fellow here, Doug Gibson, that I spoke to a few years ago. He built his own home, as did many of the other people on the same block. They formed intense friendships. They were very, very busy making friendships for a period of 5 to 10 years, from the late 40s through the late 50s. Very intense friendships, and that's what S.D. Clark talks about. He says, really, sociologically speaking, the suburban process is just about done within 5 to 10 years. And a place ceases to be a suburb after 5 to 10 years, roughly speaking. I think he goes too far, but I think there's some truth to that. There's a physical process of, there's a physical novelty, there's a sociological novelty, which matters, which I think needs to be thought about, and in all sorts of different settings. So, for example, those spontaneous settlements around Lima and other Peruvian cities in the late 1950s and 1960s, there are some actually quite interesting accounts of how those areas were developed, and so what people made of them, how people felt about them, people who were building and settling and so on and so forth. And there was this very intense period of community formation. Okay, moving really and truly to the last segment now, the last part of the last segment. What about lessons? Because I think part of the point of bridging these segregated literatures is that one literature may hold some lessons for another. And in particular, what I want to focus on are the lessons I think that we can learn for thinking about suburbs from looking at those suburbs or fringe areas in the developed world. I'm going to, again, highlight some main points and then just illustrate them very quickly. Contradicting the usual image of suburbs in the West, a lot of suburban residence is, and certainly has been, involuntary. It's not chosen. A lot of it's temporary. I'm not saying the settlements themselves are temporary. I'm saying that the people in those places are not there necessarily for a very long period of time. Often, very often, and this does come back again to Doug Saunders' book, the suburban settlement embodies movement to the city and not from the city. And that's a huge issue, a very important issue. People aren't rejecting the city, they're trying to get to it. And this I think is just as important, although maybe not as dramatic. Often suburbanization involves no movement whatsoever. People, those rural villages are engulfed by urban growth. There were people there before, they're still there now, and now they've been simply brought into the metropolitan urban field, quite alike. So they haven't moved to the city or from the city, they've just been absorbed by it, engulfed by it. And then, of course, what about all these people who grow up in suburbs? They didn't move there from anywhere. They weren't engulfed, they were born there, they were raised there, they are indigenous. So let me just again just illustrate some of these points. On the point of involuntary suburbanization, if you look in Hong Kong, Singapore, quite a number of other, in fact, cities in those early post-war years, they had squatter settlements, and these people were then resettled in resettlement estates. The ground plan of some of those. A lot of that older resettlement housing has been torn down, but there's still bits and pieces of it still in Hong Kong. These were, at the time they were built, brand new estates, and people had very little choice about whether or not they lived there. In many cases, they were happy to go there. The housing was a lot better, but they didn't have much choice about it. This was an involuntary move. Similarly, in many parts of what was once the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, Leipzig, for example, suburban estates, again, effectively resettlement, public housing estates, where people were relocated. Sometimes happily, sometimes not. But either way, not necessarily having a lot of choice about it. Many suburbs contain, the suburbs themselves may be fairly permanent, but many suburbs contain people who are mobile. Whether they're illegal immigrants, whether they're legal immigrants, but who are mobile for a whole variety of reasons. And this is true everywhere from California to China. They're in transit. So we shouldn't think about them as suburbanites, as we might, or even squatter settlers, as we might normally think about those things. There's, I've already mentioned this a couple of times, the whole issue of movement to the city. Huge numbers. I mean, Saunders is arguing that this is really where, sort of in the midst, or maybe the early phases of one of the last really great periods of human movement in history. The final steps or final stages in the urbanization of the world. And the way it's happening in very large numbers is people moving from rural areas to urban areas, but they're not moving to the inner city, they're moving in many cases to fringe. In fact, you are on quote him. Here he says, on the periphery is the new centre of the world. So, that's his theme, and it's a very important theme. And then there is a theme, which I just mentioned, the incorporation of rural villages into growing urban areas. And an early study of this, I mean, this is quite a topic in research these days, but an early study of this is by Ronald Dorr, a study of a Japanese village in, well, it's, it started beyond the urban field of Tokyo, and he looked at it, he spent some time there in the 1950s, and then followed it forwards in time as it was drawn into the urban economy. And this will be a familiar face to many of you. Jane Jacobs picked up on that, and she used it, his study for her own purposes. But the book, the original book itself, I think is an interesting study, but an early study of exactly this type of phenomenon, of the village being drawn into the urban area. Lots of people have been made suburban that way. And then there's just lots of people who grow up in suburbs. Probably many of the people in this room, myself included. And suburbanisation, and the experience of suburbanisation, isn't one of movement to, from, you know, movement from the city or movement from rural areas. It's simply, well, this is where we are. And I think that that's a neglected aspect as well. So, my typology. What I've tried to indicate here with these little check marks is, you know, there's the traditional Western stereotype. Suburbs as places of voluntary movement, where people have chosen to move. They're permanent settlements, but also the movement that's taken place is fairly permanent. I think, and they're moving out. They think that they're planning to be there for a substantial period of time. Of course, these are also places where lots of people grow up in suburbs as well, and the main purpose has been to move away from the city. That's that stereotype that I described before. If we look at the developing world, the global south, a non-trivial amount has been involuntary. The movement to the suburbs has been involuntary. Sometimes people have been displaced. People have been engulfed, and of course that happens, you know, as well as Tokyo. And they're moving to the city, not necessarily away from it. They're drawn by the urban economy, the possibilities, the prospects of the urban economy. That's my opinion.
Heads with amazing images and ideas, and we have a little bit of time to actually follow up and engage you in a discussion, so the floor is open. Stefan, no. Just a second, I didn't see you, sorry. Stefan, go ahead, please.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for a very good presentation. This is the first one for us, but I have a couple of comments. First of all, about way you just set up. I think I'm pretty much more if you were to talk about Anglo-Americans there, you talk about the suburbs. This talk, in fact, what you describe as the reality that contradicts the stereotype is the reality that contradicts the Anglo-American stereotype. Our own suburb, but the image of the high-rise, or even the image of the self-built, is still there.
Yes.
So your use of that example doesn't so much illustrate alternatives. It's about a different kind of stereotype, different kind of place. And I think similar things could be said about some other parts. So that, you know, sort of a, otherwise, of course, I think in terms of where there's still yes, those are just interesting not one of the suburbs, but the story of every suburb and the suburb, the 40 homes, 5 homes, is of course set in Central Park.